everybody, and welcome to another Recovery Radio broadcast, recorded live at the Latol Recovery Center in downtown Moscow. Recovery Radio is an outreach of the Latol Recovery Center located at 531 South Main Street in Moscow. You can contact the LRC by phone at 208-883-1045 or by email at latolrecoverycenter@gmail.com. You can also find them on the web at latolrecoverycenter.org or on Facebook. Recovery Radio's purpose is to share with our community how recovery from addiction and mental health issues affects us all, to make our community aware of the recovery resources available in our area, and to share the personal stories of people in and around recovery, highlighting their experiences, insight, and hope for continuing in recovery.
And I am Radio Johnny, and I am a grateful recovered alcoholic, recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. And yes. My partner today
I'm Denise, and I'm a grateful recovering addict and a follower of Jesus Christ.
Today in the studio with us, we have a guest, and his name is Jay. Jay, welcome to Recovery Radio.
Thanks, Johnny. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, and we're going to start off today with our usual pattern. We're going to have Jay tell us a little bit about his history. Basically, his experience in his days of pre-recovery, then what happened to get him to step out of the darkness into the light, so to speak, how things are today. So, Jay, I'm going to throw it over to you and just have you tell us a little bit about yourself and where your journey has led you.
Okay, well, I guess I started out in Idaho Falls, Idaho, and I lived there for like 20 years. And then I guess I went through a series of geographicals that, you know, took me to Pittsburgh and then to Switzerland and then back to Pittsburgh and California. And then I ended up in Japan for like 10 years. And that's where I really hit bottom. I suffer from manic depressive disorder. And so, you know, alcohol serves to kind of like, oh, I feel terrible, I'll drink alcohol now. And then I feel, and it's like being on a trapeze where somebody keeps pushing it higher and higher, you know.
Right.
So anyway, I finally hit bottom. My training's in electrical engineering. I have a STEM degree, and but most of my career I was a consultant and doing database engineering. My last job, I was working for the Walt Disney Company over in Tokyo. That was the last time I was employed for a while. I got into the program there because my sister 12-stepped me. You know, I was like, you know, saying, well, you know, I'm deeply suicidal, and she said, well, you know, AA is free and they don't care if you cry. And I said, that's perfect. That ticks all the boxes for me. So turns out, you know, I looked on the web and there was a Keitai Denwa, you know, a cell phone number for this guy called Ralph, and he said, you know.
Ralph in Japan.
Yeah, he's like, I think he was a veteran. He's definitely a veteran of Vietnam, but also, I think maybe also Korea. And he, a lot of military people just kind of end up in Japan, you know.
Right,
either
right.
Still active service or just marry some Japanese woman and end up staying over there.
Right.
But anyway, so he met me in Nagishi Station. I had no idea where that was until I showed up and he was there. And then I went to my first meeting, and I didn't, you know, think of myself as having a drinking problem. I just knew I was depressed. And then it turned out that, you know, that became, you know, later. And so I was in the program for a couple, 3 years, and then I came back to this country, worked a program of Alcoholics Anonymous with sponsors. And so, yeah, I've been sober since 2005. That's, I've gone back to Japan a few times. I went and lived there for another 2 or 3 years on a separate occasion. And, you know, like I said, I'm actually on the right medications to manage my bipolar, which was, you know, out of the question before. You know, just I was, you know, drinking a lot, and, you know, it just doesn't make sense to throw psycho meds in. That doesn't help.
Right, right, yeah.
Not that it really hurt that much, but it just didn't have the desired effect of, like, you know.
Right, right.
So I don't know. That's I guess that's kind of I've gotten back together with my, or I'm back in communication with my family in Japan.
Right. Whereas, you have an ex-wife and a son in Japan.
Yes, I do.
As I understand.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true.
So that's good. You're back on good terms, so to speak, with
right.
that. And because I know that's an exciting thing you were talking about. There's your son's graduation from high school is coming
College.
Or excuse me, yeah. From college.
Graduating
is coming
from college.
Up.
Yeah. And we'll talk for 2 or 3 hours every time we talk, and that's every few weeks. So that's like pretty amazing. Yeah, and, you know, there was a time when it was just unthinkable. that I felt terrible about myself, and I could totally get that my family would also feel terrible about me and not want to talk to me and stuff.
Right.
And that has changed, you know, completely. And it's a direct result of working the steps. So he's working in ninth step with, mm-hmm. with my family. Probably actually several ninth steps until I, you know, finally got it right. But
right, right. And I think it's important. It's always important to get a little more backstory. You're a brilliant guy. I don't mean to stroke your ego, but it you know, it's pretty obvious.
I mean, because, I want to hear more, so go
right,
ahead.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Well,
I'm curious.
You speak four languages.
That's true.
Fluently. I know from when we worked together at, actually he and I worked together at a local manufacturing company, which will remain nameless, but
right.
their initials are SEL. And
figure that one out for yourself.
Yeah.
Think really hard.
Google that at home. You know, you worked on stuff that was, you know, way more complex than anything I can imagine. I mean, it really is, you know, advanced technology that they work on over there. And then the rest of your history, you know, globetrotting, working for Disney, and your graphic novels. And we were just before the show, we were talking about you're working on connecting with agents for to publish some of your you know, novel stuff that you've been working on for years, plus your graphic arts, what I call cartooning. I think it's graphic novels is probably more appropriate. You've got a lot going on, and I'm guessing a lot of this probably never would happen without sobriety coming into the picture.
Oh,
I
yeah,
mean,
absolutely.
Maybe you can contrast where you were in your addiction versus, you know, what you were able to do then and where you're at now. I mean, that's just amazing.
Yeah, it's been a big change, and that's actually a whole aspect of my recovery that basically I've, you know, before I hit bottom, I was just like working for other people. I was working to, you know, living to work, and I was working for other people for their approval or whatever, that sort of thing. And it got just that I couldn't do that anymore. I mean, it's more like I hit bottom and I couldn't do anything. And then I'm like, well, what can I do? You know, and, mm-hmm. and it's like just, you know, being, you know, ignoring my own joy and that sort of stuff was, I just couldn't do it anymore. You know, and it's kind of like, it's almost like I was forced to give myself permission to, you know, explore things, to do things that I've wanted to do since I was like 5 years old. I mean, I wanted to be a writer and an artist since I was 5 years old, but I put that on hold because of, you know, dysfunction and I think I drank in order to make that okay, to anesthetize that, you know, I don't know, amputation of my true self or whatever. And I think,
right.
you know, and so, you know, now I don't worry about, I don't know, living up to expectations of, like, you know, how I live or how much money I make or all that sort of stuff. That's all become very, very secondary. And also, you know, there's a fear of, like, you know, if I want to, you know, say, draw cartoons or write novels, and it's like, you know, there's always this worry of, like, maybe they're not good enough or whatever. Or the bigger fear, and this is like more of an existential fear, is that maybe someday I'll just wake up and they won't do it for me anymore. And mm-hmm. I'll have to think of the next thing. And that's terrifying or something, you know. And it's like, and that's probably the bigger thing. And in sobriety and recovery, I've been able to confront those things. It's like, I'm going to try and, you know, I'm going to follow my dream. And if I wake up someday and it's not my dream anymore, then that's okay. And I'll just move on after that, you know?
Yeah. Something else will fill that void. You know, I know, Denise, you experience those sort of things. You're doing things now that you might not have ever considered before.
Yeah.
You know, your leadership role over at CR.
Mm-hmm.
I doubt seriously that when you were in your, well, you tell me.
I mean, yeah, the things that I've been able to accomplish in recovery are pretty good and a lot different than I ever would have expected. And that wouldn't be possible without being in recovery. And also, I think just the ability to come out of such a dark place and what it took me to do my program for a couple of years. And I think that really got me pretty fired up and believing in myself.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I experienced that as well. I went from being a drunk control freak that was like constantly failing at everything I tried because I was coming at it with this I've heard alcoholics described as egomaniacs with an inferiority complex. You know, that was me. That was absolutely me. You know, I would go in guns blazing saying we're going to do it this way and do it that way, and always fearful and knowing somewhere deep inside that it just wasn't going to work out or was going to fail. And then once I got sober and became humble, I think that was a key for me, was getting some humility and not putting myself constantly first, but the good in a work environment, the good of the organization, putting that first, you know, not being afraid to fail, but really giving lots of consideration before I held my hand up in a meeting and said, I'll do that, or I'll take that on, or I have an idea on how we can make this work better, faster, kinder, whatever. And that's a challenge. And getting back to you, Jay, the idea that alcohol was your treatment for a mental health issue, that, believe it or not, I have found that that's more common than not. You know, certainly I was self-medicating to deal with a lot of childhood trauma and just whatever, day-to-day challenges of my own creation through my drinking primarily. But to be able to get sober and realize that medication is actually going to be okay for you, I mean, that must have been some sort of mental struggle right there.
Yeah, I think, you know, alcohol is a very powerful medication. I mean, it's more of a sledgehammer than a scalpel, you know? I mean, that's right. Definitely, I don't think anybody's going to disagree with that one. And yeah, I think I put this in one of my novels, actually, is I resisted the idea of getting on medication because it seemed like I was kind of nailing myself down at that point or somehow, or I don't know, I had some kind of weird excuse. Actually, it just seems so weird now that I was, and I think, like, a lot of stuff in retrospect, too, like it was said, I forget how exhausting it was being a control freak. Because that was me. I mean, it's just exhausting. And the thing was, I was a system administrator type. I'm not just like somebody who, like, you know, clicks and drags on the admin screen on some PC. This is way before that. This is like, I was writing the code that determined what people's lives were going to be for 8 to 10 hours a day, like everybody in the building type thing. You know, that was, and I thought, wow, that was, you know, coincidentally, you know, hey, am I a control freak? I don't know. I had absolute control whether I was freaking about it or not. I don't know. But it just kind of, you know, you look back and you see those things like, that's an interesting data point. And so that's what I did. You know, everybody, I mean, I tried to be a benevolent dictator, you know, of course.
Right, yeah.
You know, I mean, but, you know, that's the way it's going to be, you know, my way, and that's it. There's no highway or anything. You know,
right.
And so just, that's an exhausting thing to do. I have to make all those decisions, especially writing code. It's like you write 10 lines of code and you are going to have to live with that for the rest of your career at that company. And, you know, and it's just like, so hopefully I don't make a mistake. You know,
it's like no pressure.
No pressure at all. Just another easy day at the job. Yeah, I don't have to think about this too much. Oops, I just deleted all the CEOs.
I've done that a couple of times. A couple of times is enough. You know?
Right, exactly. Exactly. Where are my files, Jay? Files?
So, maybe three times.
So all I can come up with for writing codes is that my kids, because they're younger, they're like 10 and 13, they learn these kinds of things in school now. But right. I did not. Did you learn these kinds of things in school?
No. Well, when I went to school, there were no microprocessors.
Right. So your schooling was done. This was in college.
Oh no! I've been writing code since I was about 12 years old.
Wow. And
we had a deck computer. Right. So our school district had that, and then we had classes where we could actually go and hack on that. And then I got my own personal computer later. So it was kind of at the wave of that. So I've written probably. Altogether, I've probably written like 1,250,000 lines of code or something in, you know, various languages, maybe a lot more than that. But yeah, I've been doing that since forever. There are a number of companies, including Disney, who probably are still running a lot of my code. You know, lots and lots of my code is still running.
That's so cool. See, I needed to be sitting next to him in class when we had our big apples out. They were like the big, you know, they had the big, I don't know if it was the modem or whatever, but they're gigantic, and you turn them on all the way in the back.
Sure.
That was hard to even reach, and I didn't know what in the world I was doing, and no one was teaching us anything. Like, it was just like, turn it on, use it. Okay.
Yeah, right. Yeah, no.
I mean, you guys realize I'm like 10, right? Okay.
Yeah, with the
See, and I needed you to be sitting next to me, and you would have been like, right here, Denise. Oh, and just watch what I'm doing, and all the things.
Yeah, and in those early days with me being in the computer manufacturing, it's like, okay, we got these genius engineers and programmers, and they're going to dictate what parts we need to make this machine do this thing, this particular thing, or this group of things. Then they come over to me and they go, well, we can't just have all this crap laying all over the table. We got to kind of tuck it in, you know, to some sort of packaging. And, you know, we have to, you know, have an interface device of some sort. And so for me, I didn't have to write the code or do the programming. I just had to make sure that these geniuses put something together that an idiot like me could bang on and make it do the thing I wanted it awesome. To do. There were no books for it. There were no answers, just all questions. They would come over, explain how it all jammed together. We'd figure out a package for it. And then we would actually bring in people from our group, manufacturing, the quote lowest denominator on the scale, and say, all right, this thing is supposed to do this. I'm going to show you the basics of it, and you show me what you can do with it. And we found out, you know, how hard things were. We tried a lot of different languages for the interface so that people could talk to the computer, get the computer to tell them the answers they wanted. And it was all trial and error, tons of failures. And my friends used to give me a hard time because it seemed like every 6 to 12 months I was changing jobs. Well, that computer company couldn't figure it out. And, you know, many times it was fights up at the, you know, higher ranks, you know. Finance says we have to get this much for it, but manufacturing says it costs 10 times more than that to build the damn thing. And programming's been checked out for, I don't know, a couple of months, and they say they can't. Anyway, it was, you know, it's turned into this big.
Jeez, man. Oh, were you drinking after work? Because I feel like that was a lot.
It was like you know.
Seems like a lot of pressure and a lot of stuff.
12-hour days were pretty much the standard. A 40-hour week from 1975 till 1998. I never worked a 40-hour week.
Sounds like you were a little bit of a workaholic a little bit there.
40 days. Oh, yeah. Well, and that was, then the alcoholism kicks into it because everything that's done revolves around a relief valve, which in those days in that environment was alcohol. Right. Friday afternoon, 5 o'clock, beer 30, company meeting, cases and cases of beer and wine. Everybody gets juiced up. The VP's getting fist fights. It was exciting.
And that's the thing you were saying like a couple of weeks ago. I just want to punch somebody in the face when I was like, I just want to talk about my feelings. So that's how you guys dealt with it. And then some of the other people probably talked about their feelings and you guys duked it out. There we go.
Right, all right. Exactly. So it was, you know, it was madness, but that was the social lubricant. And then throw in some childhood trauma, some really, you know, negative events in my life. And that was all it took for me to decide that alcohol was the answer and the question.
Right.
And I, you know, rolled with it until I got sober. Yeah, this just kind of, I mean, I have empathy for what you went through. You know, I didn't have the experience of the severe mental health condition that you struggle with, but I can only imagine that sort of deal. You know, you went through some family crisis. Now, was that not only with your wife and your child in Japan, but Denise and I have talked about how we went through family traumas and twos. And it kind of goes back to my belief that I was an alcoholic for a long time before I ever drank.
Yeah, I think that's true. And, you know, it's kind of like, you know, where have you been all my life or something at age 14, you know,
but yeah.
It's like, you know, it's like, right. Start, right. You know, get drunk for the first time. I mean, a lot of it, you know, goes hand in hand. I mean, what do they talk about, like in the AA Big Book, they talk about the five different kinds of alcoholics, and number four is like perfectly normal except when I drink. And it's like, and like nobody is like that, you know. That's the joke, you know. It's
right,
like
yeah.
Everybody else is, no, you're a complete sociopath even when you're not drinking, you know. Right. It's like, but, and that's it's like, yeah, my family is like, you know, I have like what's called complex PTSD. And it's like, you know, it's just years and years and years of a very dysfunctional environment. Yeah, I found out just recently, it's like, I think I already knew it. There's a buddy of mine, it's good to talk to him. It's good to talk to, he has dissociative disorder, and I do too. And he refers to like dissociative amnesia.
Mm-hmm.
Which is amazing. I had the experience of like working with my brother at the aforementioned, you know, and he just, you know, he just say, well, like it's getting in there somehow, but I don't know how it is getting in there, you know, like my
right.
learning process. I think I hung all my languages off of this kind of scaffolding of emotional scarring that's like in my brain someplace, mm-hmm. you know, just like, I don't know how else to do it, but it's like just, And that makes it tough to work, you know, is because you wake up one day and you're like somebody else, you know, you or at least don't have access to the stuff you had access to yesterday, and now you have access to a bunch of new stuff, you know, and that may mean you shoot pool better today than you did yesterday, but but you can't remember. When I wrote code, I would document everything for myself, you know. I mean, everybody else thinks my code's great because it explains very clearly why the code's there, how it works, what's it doing. Oh, by the way, here's the actual instruction that runs it, you know. And then, but it's for me because when I come in, you know, one day, it's like I don't remember. I mean, when I get handed a project, the first thing I do is look to see if I've already done it. You know, you
know? Right.
There's an episode of Seinfeld that alludes to that, and it's actually very real. You know, it's just like I could have an entire software project that takes weeks or whatever, and I can't remember having just done it.
It is called dissociative amnesia.
That's my friend's term, but it's like it's a phenomenon. It's like this idea of you have dissociative disorder, you know, complex PTSD, that it's just complete, you know, lapse in memory.
I just like how you brought it to life by explaining that you would like basically explain everything to yourself really well.
Right.
You know, and leave yourself instructions because you didn't know which day it was going to be.
Yeah. You know, because I might not, you know, and it's like I say, well, you know, if it's 2 o'clock in the morning and you're exhausted, it's like you want to be able to, you know, you want to have a lot to go on or something. But it's really like I just have this terror of this experience of like looking at something that I'm supposed to know what it's all about. And I have no idea if I've even seen it before. I feel like I haven't seen it before ever. And, you know, and it's like, you know, it's like, I'll read my journals and it's like, wow, I didn't know I was that good at Russian. I can kind of read it, but there's no, you know, who, you know, it's just this feeling of like, I know I wrote it, but I don't.
I don't remember it.
I don't.
It's like, I talk about in a joking way that, especially when I'm in conversation with my wife, my brain has this buffer and it's finite. It's only so big. So when something new comes in that I need to hang on to, something's going to tip out at the other end of the buffer. You know, I experienced this with her because she's super organized in her brain and she'll say, I need you to do this. And I'm like, okay. And I start doing that. And then she'll add in, oh, I need you to do this and then this. And I'm like, okay. And then I'll finish doing the initial thing, and then I'll go to pick up something else, like maybe something I was going to do in association with that, which was not one of her requests. That's gone. That's gone.
She told you in the middle of you doing something.
Or something will occur to me while, you know, this John's rule of home ownership. Every project you start spawns two more projects,
right.
which in turn spawn two more projects. Out to infinity.
Right.
And I'll wormhole into one of those projects and I'll lose the second statement of things she wanted me to do. And she gets so frustrated with me and it's absolutely understandable. So I've gotten to a point where I have turned her into the list maker from hell.
Oh yeah.
She's got to write it down. She's got to hand it to me, or what she'll do is she'll make a list in the morning before I get up and like put it on the coffee maker. She knows I'll see it there.
Man.
And I'll fold it up and put it in my bathrobe pocket, and that's my marching orders for the day. But yeah, and there are also times where I'll finish a project and I'll look at it and go, did I do this step?
Right.
You know, something's buttoned up inside a wall. Did I tape around the outlet contacts?
After the sheetrock's already up.
Yeah, right, am I going to have to tear the wall down? Oh, no, I got to tear the wall down. That?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. That's, I mean, yeah, that's constant. Oh, no. Well, and that's why I use a Franklin planner, is because, I mean, Franklin's, I kept upgrading. Good. You know, every time somebody said, oh, here's how I keep organized, and I'm like, oh, that's way better than what I'm doing right now. So I'd, like, start doing that, you know. And then, the first job over in Tokyo, they gave planners out to the distributors, so we got to go to the class for free. Mm-hmm. You know, and I'm like, okay, I'm down with that. So I learned how to use this thing. And then I remember I was working at Goldman Sachs. There was this one time, one of the banker accountant guys, British guy, he shows up and he gave me a piece of paper that was exactly the same size as the pages in my planner. Mm-hmm. And said, here, I know you
use the Franklin man.
So he would know that he would step right to the front of the queue as far as getting his projects done first, right, because I just stuck it right in my planner and then it was right there, you
boom,
know,
and I'm ready to go. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's, you know, so organization systems are critical. I mean, like the way I take notes, I have all my notebooks are indexed. They're mm-hmm. like, they have unique names and they're indexed, and I number all the pages. And this is something I've done for years because, and you know, make sure to label stuff, because I was like, oh wow, there's like 30 pages of a draft of a novel in here that I didn't even know it existed. You know, it's just like, you know, it's like, but it'll be indexed and that sort of thing. Or the stark, you know, cold sweat terror of like finding something that's not indexed. It's like, oh my gosh, if I hadn't opened up this notebook and just absolutely been flipping through, I wouldn't have known that there were all these drawings or there was all these manuscripts or, you know, this other stuff, because it's not indexed. And, you know, and
it's like a gold mine. Is, yeah, it like a gold mine? And you're like, where did this, yeah, come from? This is a gold
or
mine.
Or a plutonium mine or something. You know, it's because, right, I discovered this. You know, it's like,
right.
Yeah, but it's, you know, no system's perfect is the point. And that's, mm-hmm. that's, you know, I try to do things in a reliable way, because I know it's the Wheel of Fortune J or something, or this Lazy Susan J that comes up.
Right.
It's a new guy's like, who doesn't remember that I did this important thing yesterday. That's going to be lost, or it's going to be done over again and probably not as well the second time, or, you know, whatever.
Or better. But I, yeah, mean, you don't know if you can't open up the book. I mean, people, you talk about journaling and how important it is. A lot of people will look at a journal and say, oh, I could have done that better. This is a learning point here. I look at a journal and I go, I can't believe I was thinking that.
Right.
You know, why was I thinking that? And I'll try and go back and recreate the environment somehow to discover why I was thinking that. And I can't do it. It's just like, wow, what in the world was going on in my head when I wrote this down? And yeah, it's a mystery.
Is it like a good night's sleep and then you're okay? Because, well, I feel like for me it's like a good night's sleep and then I'm like, what was I so upset about last night?
Well, it's not sure so much. It's not so much like I'm reading it the next day. It's right, like I'm
that,
reading,
yeah,
it.
It's, you know, later.
Weeks or months or sometimes even years later, I'll just grab a notebook and be flipping through it for some little bit of information. Because I write in notebooks and then I journal in the same notebook. And it's just kind of a gross way to keep my life organized.
Right.
You know, I'll find these little inputs that I've put in that are just like, huh? What? Why would I?
June of 19.
What the hell was going on, yeah, that, you know, I was, oh, I can't believe what so-and-so said, or I can't understand why, you know, this would have happened. And it's like, wow, nope, nothing there. Can't remember a thing.
This is like, you know, psychology 101. This is like, you know, that's about the extent of the psychology classes I've taken. But it's like they talk about state-related recall, and that kind of stuck with me for some reason. You know, supposedly, you know, you get really drunk, and then you hide some money or booze, right?
Yeah.
And then you get sober, and you can't remember where you hid it. And then you either get more drunk or less drunk, and you still can't remember. But when you get exactly the right amount, well, you may remember where other money and other booze is hidden when you're at a certain level. But when you get to the perfect level, then you remember, oh, yeah, in the stovepipe of the thing, and then, oh, yeah, behind that book, you know, stuff. That comes back to you, and it's called state-related recall. You have to be in the same state in order for your memory to have access to the same stuff. So it's like, you know, dissociative disorder is kind of the same. It's a similar kind of thing. I feel like it just kind of rolls forward randomly. You know, it's just kind of, you know, you just kind of spin the wheel, and whatever one comes up, that's what you get to, you know, remember that day, you know, and stuff like that.
Wow. But, yeah.
And And yeah, it's, I think it's like, that's how we came up with just looking at the state related recall. Like my brother and I was like, you know, what the hell's going on with me? You know? And it's like, and we discovered that that's when we first discovered, you know, dissociative disorder, you know, which is like right. multiple personality disorder is the extreme. It's called mm-hmm. dissociative identity disorder now, but I don't know. That's a huge issue, you know, I think for, you know, alcoholics and people in Al-Anon, you know, and adult children of alcoholics, you know, recovery, is that these kind of things go on. And a scary thing is, like, you know, it's like every time I meet somebody and it's like, if I don't remember specifically meeting them, you know, like their name and their phone number and, you know, how all their backstory and stuff, it's like, or like somebody sent me an email and I recognize his name and I think I know him through a certain friend who I, you know, but then no detail otherwise, you know. And of course, the mm-hmm. name's a cheat because the email had the name on it, you know. So it's like, you know, it's like, okay, I know his name. It's like, well, you know. But the idea that that if I, you know, meet somebody on the street or at a party or something like that, and they seem to know me, they may know me, and I may right. know them. But I
can't put it.
No
together.
Matter how hard I try, you know. I mean, sometimes I'll luck out and it'll come to me. You know, that's a sort of an age thing, I think, more so than is that.
Yeah, as I get older, I do recognize that I will recognize people, but can't put a name to the
name
face.
Tags.
I mean,
everybody
people that I've known
tags.
For a long time. Mm-hmm. A friend of mine was talking on the phone with him, and he was going, "Yeah, that actor." And he's, you know, he was in this movie and that movie, and we're both about the same age, and we're like struggling. I mean, I can see the guy's like, face.
Yeah.
I can see him in these yeah. films, and I'm like, oh, what is his name? And then somewhere farther down the line in the conversation, totally unrelated to that part of the conversation. Yeah, Samuel L. Jackson. That was that's his name. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm always like, I'll remember in like an hour or like tomorrow or something like that. I'll get back to you.
I have literally woke up in the middle of the night yelling.
That's what it was. Now I remember.
Bedtime with Bonzo. That was a movie with Reagan. Bedtime with Bonzo. Yeah. Yeah. So it's like,
I don't know if I've ever yelled it though.
And I think, I mean, for me, well, the age, I think this is mostly age, because there was a day that where, you know, I couldn't read my watch anymore. You know, the dates on the watch is too small. I can't read it. That just like, that was like Wednesday was okay. Then Thursday, no, it's no good. You know,
yeah,
and then also I think people, the genius factor, people perceive me as being like, know everything or whatever, because like I can recall pretty much anything I know in like less than half a second, and that's like the reaction time, you know, mm-hmm. like the 2 second rule when you're driving and all this other
right.
stuff, and if you can remember anything in less than amount of time, it seems to, but it became more than that in just the past few years, where it's just like it takes me too long to stick it into the conversation to remember stuff, you know, so that's
right.
the memory is, you know, anyway, but it's like I say, there's the scared Alzheimer, angry Alzheimer, and funny Alzheimer, you know? It's
yeah,
like,
right.
You know,
right.
it's like, there's the, a lot of people, they get angry. It's like, they're like four weddings and a funeral. It's like, hello, I'm Charles. Don't be ridiculous. Charles died 20 years ago. And
yeah,
he's like,
right.
must be a different Charles, I think.
Yeah.
You know, you're saying I don't know my own brother. You know, and it's like, that's like the angry Alzheimer. It's like, you know, your reality is not matching
right.
mine, and I'm pissed off about it. You know, it's like, and as opposed to the scared Alzheimer is like, you know, it's like, you know, nothing makes sense. You know, like, and then the funny one is like, you know, yeah, tell me the joke again. I'm not going to remember by tomorrow. You know, so
just owns it. Just totally owns it.
Yeah,
it's just this condition
exactly.
that I'm in.
So that's, I think that's kind of a recovery thing too. People who have the right attitude towards the fact that they're just, you know, crazy, you know, or, you know,
right.
that I'm trying to recover from
like
alcoholism.
I'm
and,
probably not
you know.
Going to remember your name tomorrow. So, you know,
right.
tomorrow when I see you again, make sure you say it again.
That
is
so funny, because there have been so many meetings where I've bumped into somebody and I'll have to say, excuse me, remind me of your name.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
no one gets mad about it in AA. They say, oh, I'm Bob. Oh, yeah, Bob. Sorry. And they're all like, yeah, I know what you mean. You know, it's so funny that it is just like, if it wasn't an anonymous program, we'd probably all be wearing those, hello, my name is, you know, things at every meeting, because...
Hello, my name is Inigo Montoya.
Yeah.
You killed my father. Prepare to die.
Prepare to die.
I love that movie.
Princess Bride.
Oh, my goodness. That is one of the, like, all-time favorites at my house for both my daughters and my husband. And it's like, yeah,
Okay, you guys are going to hate me. I've never seen it.
Oh, my goodness.
I take that back.
We hated you already. We hate you more now. It's like,
jeez, man. What is wrong with you? Now, see, the alcoholism and all those things were fine until you told me that you never even watched the show.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, I'm okay with it, but my kids would be like, what's wrong with you?
And the only reason I'm really even aware of Princess
As
Bride.
As you wish.
Right?
The only reason I'm even aware of it is because Mel Brooks was in it.
I think it was Billy Crystal, though.
I don't know.
Oh, wait a minute. No,
Crystal.
It was Billy Crystal.
Yeah.
Not Mel Brooks.
Yeah.
Dark hair?
But he did the... He did such a Mel Brooks kind of character in the movie. That's why it all makes me think of Mel Brooks. Well, you see, there we go. There's another confusion
yeah,
on
Johnny,
my part.
You're gonna have to
all
watch
these
that
old
show.
Jewish men starting to look alike to me.
Right.
Yeah. So,
you're past middle age then, I guess.
Yeah. Middle age? Oh, I'm way beyond
I'm kind of hoping
age.
Middle age goes to like 65. Does that work?
Well... Any more, that would probably be the norm. But, you know, COVID is cutting down our average lifespan to or back to a reasonable number again. But let's not get into that. That's a whole nother rabbit
hole.
Your lifestyle now, what you're pursuing is those things you love. You're in a relationship now.
Yes.
As I understand. How is your relationship now in recovery? And I guess what the question is like, how do you look at relationships before recovery that's different than how you look at it now?
I think more relaxed. I think it was kind of like, I'm on a worm on hot ashes because there are certain details of my relationship aren't working out. And that's just got to be fixed immediately, or I'm going to dissolve into a puddle of goo on the floor or something like that. Whereas now it's more... less impatient, less feeling like, I think it's just like, I think that my relationship is just like any other drug or addiction or something.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, if it's not working, then that's, you know, a total panic situation. And that's not the way it is anymore. You know,
right.
So it's like, so my relationship is, I don't know. It's like, it's not something that, I guess less of an emergency or something. And I think it's just for me, my own situation is like, I'm sort of in the process of continuously melting down as an addict, you know, when I was drinking and drugging and everything. And so it's almost like you running along these stepping stones. This is a metaphor I used to use before, and you're trying to hit every one so you don't fall into the bog of eternal stench. There you go.
Yeah. Like, watch the movie.
You know, and it's just like if the one stone's missing or, you know, it's not quite in the right place and you don't quite hit it, then, you know, it's and you're just going faster and faster. But now that's not happening. So if there are problems with my relationship, it's not this emergency.
Right. And you don't have to react in a frantic way.
Right. And it's not like, you know, like you're swimming under the ice and you have to come up and, oh, there's ice. Oh, I was expecting I was going to be able to breathe right then, and no, I can't, you know, and that's not the situation anymore. You
right.
know, like, oh, my relationship crapped out and the ice is like, you know, there's still a right. solid layer of ice there when I was expecting my relationship to come through for me or whatever. And that's just not the mode that I'm in anymore. Everything was just do or die. It was life and death. Everything was life and death when I was in my addiction. And so if anything... didn't quite, you know, if the ends didn't quite meet or whatever, it was a complete disaster.
Right, that's right.
Kind of like, you know, and it's the same thing with like your shoelace breaks when you're putting your shoes on in the morning, you're trying to go out to work, you know, it's just like, that's the, you know, you just go on a shooting spree or something. You know,
right, right, exactly.
Like, or just like now we'd go get a different pair of shoes, maybe change our outfit, but
yeah.
back then it could have been like the whole house gets torn down. You know?
Because, the thing is, it's like I'm on edge anyway, you know, it's like I'm on edge and that's, I'm looking for an excuse, I guess.
Right.
You know, I'm looking for an excuse. And so that my relationship is not something that provides that excuse. And it's also not something that keeps me is this
on,
release
on
valve.
Edge. Right.
Is the the same kind of release valve that alcohol and drugs were.
Right.
You know, it's not filling that role. And it's kind of like nothing's filling that role. You know, it's just like I approach life with this idea that I'm going to be sober. And things are going to be relatively okay. And if things look like they're not going to be relatively okay, I may have a choice in there someplace to like change things. And you know, before I hit the wall, you know, just stuff like that. Whereas before, it was just all you got to do is keep running, hoping that there's going to be stepping stones. And if there's a wall coming up, just brace for impact. You know, and that's
yeah.
you know, that was life.
And, right.
don't know.
Yeah, that's a great analogy where, you know, you just keep running forward and hope to God that, yeah, the stepping stone's going to be there.
Yeah,
because I spent a lot of time in, what did you call the
bog of eternal stench? Yeah,
the bog of eternal stench. Yeah.
It's pretty gnarly in there.
I spent a lot of
and
time.
If you'd
in
watch
there,
the movie,
yeah,
I
mean,
you,
how old are you by now? Like,
it's on
you're
Netflix
60s,
now,
man. Well, get on the Netflix or whatever.
I spent way too much time during that time frame of when a lot of those films were coming out. I think it was like in the 90s, wasn't it? Or late 80s,
yeah,
early 90s. That's when I was working those 16-hour
right.
days,
gotcha.
7 days a week, you know, sometimes months
you
at
a like
stretch.
Like a whole decade of everything.
Yeah, and the good part about that is I can get recommendations on movies that came out then,
right?
And I can watch them now and enjoy them. I have been in search of a full copy, you know, the entire seasons of West Wing, yeah, that's it. Because I never got to see any of those episodes. I mean, I've seen little bits and pieces, you know, which is how I fell in love with Allison Janney as an actress. There's reruns that are on now that are first runs for me.
Right.
You know, my wife is like, I've seen all this. And I'm like, you didn't work till 9 o'clock at night every night and come home exhausted and just go to bed or get drunk. Damn you.
Damn you for making good choices.
That's right. What's wrong with me? Well, we are just about up against the end of the hour. Is there anything you want to share further? Words of encouragement for people who are listening to the show that maybe are in pre-contemplation or contemplating committing sobriety, as I like to say?
Yeah. Well, I guess one thing I thought of when we were talking about software is the idea of like a bootstrap, you know, is like, how do you get things up and running? You know, and they call it a bootstrap because it's like, you've got all this crap here and there's this software that is kind of on a tape or something. And you got to and it's like the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and the system of having meetings and having sponsors are a way to sort of wade slowly into the lukewarm water of recovery without, you know, having to, you know, because, I mean, the thing about bootstrapping is you basically have to understand everything about everything all before you even start, you know, and,
right.
and that's really hard, you know, and it gives you a headache, speaking from experience. And then either before or after you get drunk because of it, you know, it's like, but the bootstrapping process is you just go to a meeting, there are people who are, they're part of their recovery is to help you get recovered, and the steps are simple and they're in order. So you don't have to worry about anything other than the step that you're on at that, you know. And so that's because when I was, you know, I didn't see a way out of all my problems. It all seemed to be this complete tangled Gordian knot mess. And I don't know, recovery just said, just work the program and things will get better in some order.
Right.
And that worked for me. And I said, this if this works the way it says, this is the only way I can see, you know, for me to get out of my problems. Because it was just, like I said, a confusing mess. And I feel like I have to do this impossible thing, and then I can do those other two impossible things afterwards. And, you know, just, you know.
Right.
So that was my take. And that's how I just kind of dove in. I didn't know what the hell I was doing. But eventually,
right.
things started
right.
getting better. I got hope straight away. And then
yep.
not much. It was a while before anything else came, but hope came straight away. And that got me a long way. Anyway.
Yeah. That's, you know, when I say I'm alcoholic of the hopeless variety, it was a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. And I don't have to be hopeless anymore because, yeah, the program gives me hope.
Right.
I'm in recovery. I am not totally recovered. I'm recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body, but I'm not fixed. I'm not cured. I'll always be an alcoholic. But at least now I'm not a drunk. And that's the important part to me. What do you think, Denise?
Amen to that. Yep.
All right. Well, we're going to wind it up here in the usual fashion by letting everyone know. You know, if you think you have a problem with drugs or alcohol or mental health issues, well, you do. Not if you can hear me.
down.